This is lecture number 7. We start our final topic of quantum gravity. Quantum gravity is a very difficult subject, and I am not going to, by any means, give you a full story of that. I'm going to give you some philosophy, some preliminaries of a point of view. However, it is often convenient to start a discussion of quantum gravity with a discussion of the electromagnetic field, because there are some parallels. First, it's the field theory, and second, it's the gauge theory. But of course, electrodynamics by itself is a linear theory, therefore it's much, much simpler, and we can carry it out in one transparency, if you will permit me. So, we start by writing the classical action in a perhaps slightly unfamiliar form. This is the so-called first order form, where I treat the A field and the F field as two independent fields. And I deduce their connection by the equations of motion. It's rather like the Hamiltonian form of mechanics, where you have P and Q, and you have an equation that defines P in terms of Q. Typically, P will equal mQ dot. That's not very interesting. You knew that already. And then the second equation is what P dot is. So here we go. We vary the A field, which only appears here. I put the derivative over here, and we get that the covariant derivative of F mu nu should vanish. When we vary the F field, which appears here and here, we get a definition of the F field in terms of the A field, as you well know. So these are the two fundamental equations in this first order form relation of electromagnetism. Let's define EI, electric field, as F0I, BK, the magnetic field, as the epsilon I, JK transformation of the FIJ, the spatial parts of the F field. And then this action functional can be put into a very familiar, classical-looking, canonical form, apart from one or two modifications, and that's the dot over the equal sign here, which means I've dispense with a few surface terms, with our integration by parts and things like that. So we have the PQ dot version here. Minus E is the momentum appropriate to this field. A plays the role of the coordinate. Here is the Hamiltonian. E squared plus B squared, as you're familiar with. Here is the A0 field, which is part of this story. There is no A0 derivative. There's only AI derivatives with respect to time, A0. And by integration by parts, that has multiplied by the divergence of the electric field. A0, then, since it doesn't appear out with a time derivative, will give us act as a Lagrange multiplier, enforcing the single constraint field, which says that divergence of E equals 0. That is, of course, in the absence of charge here. So what's our quantum story? When our quantum story, and now you're mature enough at the seventh lecture to let H bar equal 1 most of the time, we start with our E field and our A field as operators, and we say that they satisfy canonical commutation relations, so that's the delta jk on the indices and a direct delta of x minus y on the coordinates. I'm going to need some classical C number functions, and I will use lowercase for those and uppercase for the operators here. That's what I've been doing all along with regard to the p's and q's. The p's and q's as lowercase, you remember, have always been the C numbers, very much like the classical variables, and the capital P and the capital Q have been saved for the operators. Okay, I'm going to divide the electric C number field and the at the potential A field into two components, one transverse, the other longitudinal. The transverse contribution says its divergence is automatically zero, and the longitudinal part says that the curl is zero. I don't know what you call the curl in Norwegian. Curl, okay. But the curl is zero in for the longitudinal field. And similarly, for the A field, the divergence of AT equals zero, and the curl of AL equals zero. We start, oh, by the way, the A fields and the E fields are at my disposal, just like the P and the Q were. They were coordinates, if you will, in the phase space plane, and I didn't have to push them out to infinity or anything else. And much more to the point here, the E field and the A field I will choose as very smooth functions. Very smooth, and I can even make them fall off at infinity, or if I get so bold, I will make them have compact support. Smooth, infinitely differentiable, and compact support. So they are the labels, and these will be the coherent states appropriate to this problem. And they enter as multipliers, C number multipliers of the operators. So that's A dot E as three-dimensional vectors, E dot A here as three-dimensional vectors, integration over the spatial coordinate times an appropriate fiducial vector, which is going to be the ground state of the Hamiltonian that's soon to emerge out of this story. So, what is the overlap of two coherent states? Well, it has a phase factor, which is this first term, and it has a an amplitude factor, which is the second term. The symbol J, which appears here in the summation and here as a subscript, stands for only two things. It stands for the transverse and the longitudinal. So it says that, let's just read one of these terms, where this, say, is the transverse. So that's E double prime transverse dotted with A prime transverse. A prime is the argument on the right. E double prime is the argument on the left. And minus a similar quantity over here. And then a sum for a corresponding integral appropriate to the longitudinal component. Secondly, I have E to the minus a quarter, the sum again on the transverse and longitudinal components. I'm sorry, your reproduction was not so perfect in this area, so you if you look at your paper, you'll find it's not ideal. EJ, now here I have a tilde on top and a tilde underneath. The tilde underneath means three-dimensional vector, and the tilde on top denotes Fourier transformation. So, that's life. There's another school of field I work with, the people in the wavelet community, and they put a caret on the top to signify Fourier transformation. But caret for physicists, especially quantum physicists, means operator, and so we shouldn't mix that together. Here we go. So we're now in momentum space for that. The Fourier transform of this field, since it's such a nice smooth field in a configuration space, it's going to be also a correspondingly nice field in K space. So here is the difference between the two E's divided by omega. Omega is simply the modulus of K, and the difference in the two A's. Okay. Now, remember, we're doing quantization before we do reduction. There is a constraint in this theory. That's the divergence of E should be zero. That means these three electromagnetic field components cannot be considered all physical. But following the ideas of the projection operator approach to doing quantum constraints, we quantize first. So all the variables get quantized. So we have, at the moment, we have three A fields and three E fields. The C numbers, I will trade little a for little b. B is the curl of A. This is the corresponding magnetic field that comes from this vector potential. Only the transverse part of that survives this curl, and that gives us a transverse vector BT. And in Fourier space, it simply says that the AT, here's the Fourier notation, AT squared vector is proportional to the BT squared vector, with the proportionality being this omega squared. Okay. Now we're ready to reduce. Introduce dynamics and reduce. Reduce meaning, enforce the constraint. Here is the projection operator, which was the subject of the last two lectures, in which the operator version of divergence of E squared is less than some small parameter. That's the delta. And we let the delta go to zero since that lies in the continuum spectrum of that operator. We have to magnify that by this denominator factor. Okay? We take the limit, and the result is only the transverse part survives in the phase vector.
Why is that?
Because when E is divided into its transverse and longitudinal part, and the longitudinal part is set to zero by this condition, then that means there is no longer any multiplier for A longitudinal, the C number longitudinal. So A longitudinal cannot appear in the answers. So it is not part of the phase vector as it was part of the original phase vector. Moreover, the expressions for the amplitude factor have been now transformed back into x space, so we have a double integral in x space, d3x, d3y, and we have the the difference of the two vectors x and x comma t. I'll explain what the t means in a minute. Y minus t, we have to do that because when we take this back into configuration space, we have to split that. The divisor is x minus y squared. Similarly for the b story over here. And when we use this omega squared for that, the omega comes in the denominator, so we get a corresponding denominator. And, okay, let's do the t part now. The t part means that these classical C number variables evolve according to the classical dynamics. This is a linear system. So classical dynamics and the quantum dynamics agree with one another. And all you need to do to account for the Hamiltonian is to evolve the C numbers in their proper temporal fashion that they had in the classical theory. Finally, what about E sub L? We have E sub L dropped out. We have A sub L still around. A sub L has not gone away. I haven't put on a gauge condition for A sub L. E sub L multiplies little E sub L. And where does E sub L appear? It doesn't appear here. It doesn't appear here. It only appears in this last line. It appears as two multiplying factors. One belonging to the double prime variables, and one belonging to the prime variables. There is no mixture between the prime and the double prime, as there is here and as there is here. What does that mean? That means that this is simply a numerical factor on this side and a numerical factor on that side. I could pre-multiply this expression over here on the left by this and by that. And since there's no mixing between the two sides, it would disappear altogether. In short, I have a reproducing kernel for my physically reduced space, complete with dynamics, in which I have not fixed the gauge, but these variables play no important role at all. All right. Now, I'm sure there's questions about electromagnetism. It's not the main subject of today, and I would appreciate that we didn't divert too much attention away from our main subject. Let's talk about gravity and start with classical gravity. Here is the classical action of the Einstein version of classical gravity. It involves the scalar curvature as a function of g, the metric, four-dimensional metric, and the square root of minus g for transformation reasons, the integral over d4x sub constant, I will immediately set equals unity. And you vary that with respect to g, which is actually a major effort, and you find the equations of motion, which are right here, the Einstein equations of motion. However, there is a slick trick by Mr. Palatini, which also puts this in first order form.
Up here, this was second order derivatives involving the G, but here this is first order form. And it says, take the Ricci tensor in terms of the gammas. This was the Riemann-Christoffel tensor, and then you contract it on two of the four indices. And you have still a function of the gammas here, and this function of the G outside, which the final contraction to make the scalar curvature. However, we treat these as independent quantities. We treat the G as a variable and the gamma as an independent variable. We haven't specified yet the connection that you know very well exists between gamma and the metric. We're going to recover that from the definition. So, we vary the G by itself right here. And this term and this term combine together to give you these two terms made out of the gammas. Purely, they don't enter at all into this first variation. And that gives you the basic Einstein equation of motion. And then the second variation is to vary the gammas. So these linear terms will come back here and introduce derivatives. These quadratic terms will give you something proportional to gamma. And what you get is the general recover the straight definition of the gamma in terms of the g's. Very much like what we had in our electromagnetic case, very much like what you have in any traditional Hamiltonian version. Okay, now, we want to go Hamiltonian-like. We like operators, we like quantum theory from the point of view of operators and Hamiltonians. So we have to split things into space and time. It's called a 3 plus 1 split. Of course, if you're dealing with a three-dimensional space, which we will, ijk, 1, 2, 3, mu nu, 0, 1, 2, 3. So that's the time. Represented by the Greek letters and the Latin letters to denote this space. So we have this little gift each of our lectures. Now, for a few moments here, I'm going to talk about four-dimensional metric and three-dimensional metric. And to make it clear, the four-dimensional metric will get a little four attached to it. It's going to soon disappear from the story, but just to make the connection clear. So the four-dimensional metric is divided into blocks, 3x3, which that's called the spatial metric, and that has the important, physically fundamental, absolutely necessary. Have I made my point? This is critical fact that as a 3x3 matrix, it's positive definite. It says the distance between any two spatial points which are not the same has got to be positive. It's a physical property. Okay. The component here, which is a 3x1 vector, a 3x1 vector here, those are called n sub j. They involve the g0 i's. And this component down here, g0 is written in terms of these factors, n squared minus nj squared. This is due to Arnowitt, Dazer, and Misner. It's their version of the 3 plus 1 form of general relativity. So we're going to take the gij's as our fundamental quantities, and the nj's and the n will become our Lagrange multiplier. we look for the pi's, the guys canonically conjugate to these guys, and they are defined in terms of the 4g, the 4 gamma, but with three indices. Here, this is a temporal index upstairs, but these are 1, 2, 3 indices down here and here. In any case, it's some combination of the variables, which gives you the pi's and the g. And when you do that, and you reform what the original actual action was, then again up to a surface term, this is the version you get. And I put important equations for these two lectures in red boxes. So, well, red you won't have on your papers, but in boxes you will see. So here it comes, minus g pi dot. So why didn't I do it the other way around? Pi g dot. Many people do. This is the way it comes to you from the story, because the G's are out here, somewhere in here, there's a pi dot. This is the way it comes to you. I think this is actually a very useful way to look at it. It's not important. And then finally, the extra terms, Na, which are the raised indices of these, and when you raise Latin indices, you always do it with a three-dimensional inverse G here. And H sub A, that's going to be the constraint quantity, and capital N, the other Lagrange multiplier times that constraint.
and we'll list the constraints in a second. We just now say let's vary the variables we have. We vary the g and the pi. We get g dot and pi dot equals something. It's not important. And we vary the Lagrange multipliers, Na, we get Ha, and this is exactly what it means, minus 2 pi AB, one up, one down, slash B means the covariant derivative on the three-dimensional space, equal to 0. And vary the N, get the H, this is called the diffeomorphism constraint, this is called the temporal constraint, much more complicated, 1 over G pi squared kind of term, plus G times the three-dimensional scalar curvature, should be 0. Okay. So we have 16 equations and 16 unknowns. We have G and pi, there's 6 of each of those, because this is 1, 2, 3, symmetric. And we have 4 of the n's that are to be solved for. Okay, we have fundamental Poisson brackets to start with. G should commute with G, and pi should commute with pi. However, G and pi should have standard canonical commutation relations. That's the story of canonical quantization. Page number 4.3. We have the constraints. We have HA and H are constraints. And we have learned from our previous lectures that it's important to talk about the consistency of the constraint. That is, what is the time derivative of the constraints look like? The time derivative should be 0. And the time derivative involves the commutator of the constraints with themselves. Okay, so here is the constraint Poisson bracket set. And I put it in red box because that's a very important set of equations. HA and HB, those are the diffeomorphism constraints. That means on the surface you are sliding your coordinate system left and right. Whereas H represents the temporal, and that means you're moving your coordinate system up and down. So anyway, here's the Poisson bracket of HA and HB. It involves the derivative of the Dirac delta function at comma A there, and HB, and then symmetrized, anti-symmetrized over here. Here is the Poisson bracket of the HA with the Hamiltonian constraint. That's proportional to the Hamiltonian constraint. And here, finally, is the troublesome fellow, the Poisson bracket of the Hamiltonian constraint at two different positions, x and y, and that's proportional to delta comma a, hb, but there is a metric factor gab inside needed because you have to contract over those indices. Well, if h vanishes, as we assume it does on the constraint hypersurface of the classical theory, then it vanishes, the Poisson brackets vanish on that same surface because here's an h, and here's an h. But the coefficients are not simply numbers. This we could call a number, this we could call a number, but this is not a number. This is one of the variables, one of the dynamical variables. So that's what we call an open first-class constraint system. And open first-class constraint systems potentially have trouble when you quantize them. We gave an example of that in our last lecture about a system which was modeled on the effort to do this, that which had a first-class open system, but which became second-class when it was quantized. That was in our previous lecture. In any case, as I said before, we have our 16 equations, 6 plus 6 for the GAB and the pi AB, plus 4 for the Ns, equations of motion for these variables, but the Na and the N are not determined by the equations of motion. That's what happens for first-class constraint systems. Indeed, it seems perfectly reasonable that they shouldn't be, because they give you the freedom to describe on future time slices how you set up your coordinate system. Okay. You're not going to find the solutions for GA and GB, however, unless you actually choose the NA and the NB. You're not going to find the solutions for the G and the pi unless you fix the NA and the N, and that amounts to fixing the future coordinate system, choosing a gauge. Now, all this was more or less known in the 1960s. And procedures of the day consisted of
reducing the physical variable, that is to say, reduce in the classical theory, solve for the constraints, solve the constraints. There's four constraint equations, solve them to eliminate four variables from the 12 that you have here. And then after you've done that, impose coordinate conditions. That's like dynamical gauge fixing. If you remember what we called the chi alphas in the Fadeev Popov story of kind of constraint quantization, that's choosing the chi alphas. Well, if I solve the four constraints and I impose four conditions, that takes four and four away from 12, leaves me with four, that leaves me with two momenta and two coordinate left over, the physical degrees of freedom. But this is an incredibly nonlinear problem. And even so, even if you were able to do it, it's unlikely that the P's and Q's that you get from this will be Cartesian. So that route did not offer much success. Okay, well, we're not going to eliminate the constraints beforehand. That's not the rule we follow for projection operator method. We quantize all the G's. We quantize all the pi's for a second. So here we are talking about the kinematics. Projection operator method insists on no reduction. One must quantize all the G's and the pi's. So we do that. Subject. Have I made it clear that this matrix, 3x3 matrix, must be positive? Definite. And then, after we've done that, we're going to reduce in the quantum theory. So let's do that. It's not going to work. We're going to find a major problem. We're going to have to find a way around that. But here we go. We put little hats on the G's. Now they become operators. Pi hat becomes an operator. These are our canonical commutation for these. The G's commute with the G's. The pi's commute with the pi's. Now, first off, you should know that when you deal with a field operator, this is an algebra, first off, but secondly, you will need to represent it. And there are infinitely many, not 12 or 100, but infinitely many inequivalent, unitarily inequivalent, irreducible representations of these operators. Which one do you choose? Well, that's a major problem. However, before we go into that section, let's talk about the algebraic properties of this, rather than representation properties. So all representations, because of the algebra, must have the following situation. Let me imagine that I integrate pi hat with a nice smooth function u, and I bring it upstairs in an exponent, e to the I of that kind, and e to the minus on this kind, and let that act on left and right side of g hat, like that. It's kind of like a unitary operator and its adjoint on this side. Of course, to talk about the adjoint means you need to know representation, so we're not quite that way. We're just talking of algebra at the moment. But in any case, expand this out in power series, use this rule here, and you'll find this becomes g hat cd plus u cd, of course, times the unit matrix. No surprise there. Pi acts to translate g hat, and here it is translating as it's supposed to do. It gave us a new g, but the new g no longer need be positive definite. Well, now it's time to call for help. We're on our network television program. We have a difficult question, so we call our friend at home for some help. We have such a program like that in the United States, and I pray to God that you do not have such a thing. Anyway, we're going to call for help from a single degree of freedom problem that we talked about in our first two lectures, the affine variables. Take a single QP commutator to be I, here at H bar is again equal to unity, but we're going to insist that Q be positive. That's the analog of that. And here we put up something similar to this, e to the I u capital P, e to the minus I u capital P on each side, do the algebra, that's q plus p, and again, no longer positive definite. We destroyed that. So that's exactly one-dimensional analog of this very same problem. Solution, very easy. Multiply this equation by capital Q. capital Q here, capital Q here. Here's the capital Q, here's the capital Q. Bring this Q inside to define a new operator D, which is a dilation operator, half symmetric combination of QP and PQ. Forget the P. This is your new basic fundamental kinematical commutation relation. Ask, is it possible to find self-adjoint operators Q and D for which satisfy this and Q is positive? Well, check it. E to the IUD Q, E to the minus IUD gives us a multiplier. E to the U times Q, which is still positive. Happiness. We get our result. We would get what we want out of that. So this suggests for our quantum theory, and this is historically accurate representation of it, suggests replacing the canonical momentum, back in the classical theory here, pi AB, by multiplying it by Q. Well, Q, RQ is downstairs, and why don't we sum on one of the indices to reduce things? So we are effectively lowering one of the indices of the pi. Lower one of the indices on the pi. So sometimes I call this the mixed valence momentum, but for this advanced erudite audience here, I will give you the full proper name I have christened for this. Taken from the word momentum here and metric from here, we take the momentric, so we call it a momentric field. Don't worry about it. Okay, so that's our new classical fundamental field. Well, so we have to go back and start over with new classical Poisson. Poisson bracket between pi and pi is now much more complicated because it's pi times g. These are just straight away from the classical Poisson brackets we had before between pi 2 upstairs and g 2 downstairs. In any case, this is the momentric field Poisson bracket. Pi gives a pi, rather like a current algebra. Here is g pi giving g's. 2g should be 0, and we, of course, maintain our fundamental requirement of the g's over here. This is a representation of the inhomogeneous general linear group in three dimensions. So we have our new classical variables. From a classical point of view still, how are we doing? Well, it doesn't really matter whether we use the original variables two indices up, the canonical momentum, or the canonical momentric field. It doesn't matter, because whatever we get over here, we can always bring it back to the original field in classical theory. Happily, those new Poisson brackets also close to a Lie algebra, and they will have the same Lie algebra structure when we quantize them. So here's another important set of equations in a red box. We now quantize our new variables, which are the metric and the mixed valence index momentum, according to the original variables we had, according to the original Poisson brackets we had on the previous transparency. So here we have the operator fields for the momentric, again, equal to the two of those give another momentric. Metric and momentric give a metric. Two metrics equal to zero, and we insist, and we hope we get it this time, that we have a positive definite metric. And here's an algebraic consequence of these relations. Put this time the mixed momentum upstairs with a suitable testing function, smooth function, one side with a positive sign, one side with a negative sign. And let that act on G, carry out the algebra, and what do you find? You find the original matrix with a matrix transformation on the left and the right-hand side, which manifestly preserves positivity. It's very much like a coordinate transformation, except there's no requirement that the gamma have to be a partial derivative of anything. Okay, so we're happy with that. And we accept these now as the fundamental kinematical operators for the theory. Well, what about our two variables upstairs, which was okay classically, still barely on the screen up here. It's okay classically, but it is not okay quantum mechanically, because these are field operators and I'm multiplying them at a point. This is what I would have to do to raise the index here, and there is literally no way
you can do that. This is not an operator. Even after you smear it, it's something called a form, which is a lower form of animal on the evolutionary scale from operator. Okay. So these are generators of a group called the affine group. They both generate unitary transformations. So I put them upstairs in exponent. Call that family a U to suggest the unitary nature of it. Multiply two elements like this. The group property will just say combine the parameters in a certain way. Take linear combinations of that, and you have the elements of the algebra, affine algebra. All right, now we must choose a representation. This is a real stumbling block. Because in our problem, the quantum gravity, you should have noticed that the entire Hamiltonian was constraint. There was an Na times Ha minus an additional term was N times H. There's no separate Hamiltonian like there is for the electrodynamics, which will survive again. We have to resist thinking about the reduction until we've done our quantization. That is to say, following the rules of quantization first, reduction second, we must choose a representation at the beginning before we have even brought into the story the appropriate constraints. Well, okay, let's do that. A representation is given by choosing a vector. Now, technically, it's a state on an algebra, but from the GNS reconstruction theorem, that gives us a vector representation. So here is our fiducial vector. These are our unitary transformations, and these are our coherent states associated with the with the affine group. So I'm going to choose two basic properties of eta. One is so simple, let's begin with this. Number two down here. We're going to take the expectation value of the momentric operator pi in the state eta, our fiducial vector, to be zero. On the other hand, the expectation value of the metric operator, eta, could that be zero, ladies and gentlemen? Could that be zero? That's a positive definite operator. It cannot be zero. It has to be something. We'll call it g tilde of ab. It's like a metric. Symmetric in the two indices. Better be making a 3x3 matrix which is positive. And this particular metric will fix the topology and the asymptotic nature of the space-like surface. For example, what do I mean by asymptotic nature? I talked about the smearing functions, the pi and the gamma here, which are smoothing out these operators. We can think of them as, let's do it, as of compact support. So if I move outside that compact support, then they're not there. So if I move away, far away out here in the here, then this is exposing the eta, and so this is determining what is the asymptotic nature of the space line. In a moment, you'll see how that thing just miraculously disappears anyway. And that moment is upon you. Let's take the algebraic consequence of this simple postulate here and the properties of the affine operators themselves. We can take the diagonal coherent state matrix elements of the operator itself. Well, here's the e to the gamma fellow, the e to the gamma fellow on not on g, the operator, but now g tilde, the expectation value of that operator in the fiducial vector. This is a transformation of this original topological metric here, and we'll call that GAB, whatever it is. We'll call it GAB. Far away in a open system where the gammas have vanished, then this thing will become G tilted. But in the middle here, it can be arbitrary. Likewise, the diagonal coherent state matrix elements for the momentric field are given by pi AB. Well, that's natural. It uses the same pi, which is the label in the coherent states itself upstairs. But it is next to it is the metric GBC. Which metric? It is this very metric up here we have just defined from this combination. So this we can use to lower that index and define now a classical combination of these two, which is the mixed valence momentric. This is a very helpful, useful result we have. Remember how we talked very often about how the diagonal coherent state matrix elements of operators are related to their classical values. Well, here it is. Diagonal coherent state matrix elements of the metric equals the classical, if you will, C number metric. And the diagonal coherent state matrix elements of the momentric operator equal the C number momentric field for the principle.
Okay. Again, to proceed, we have to finish the definition of eta. This is only the beginning. It's only a few little pieces of what eta should do. We now ask for help again from our single degree of freedom and the guidance from that. Here is what we did for the affine commutation relation. We had an eta. We had our affine operators Q and D. Q and D are exactly parallel to the metric and the momentric field here. This is logarithm of Q is our label, Q positive. Well, that's okay because E to the gamma is what it turns out to be here, and that's if we took the logarithm of that somehow, then that would be okay. Perfectly natural. E to the IPQ is exactly analogous to that. We put on our expectation value of Q. Here we chose 1. Here we chose this. Expectation value of D, we chose to be 0. Here is the same, 0. And we got out of that the coherent state, here coherent state, diagonal matrix element of the operator Q was little q. That's the exact parallel to this statement. And matrix element of the operator D was P times Q. There it is, P times Q, which we've given this Q of the momentric. And now when we did the affine field, we did one more thing. We finished and gave us a full eta. How did we choose the full eta in that case? These operators satisfy a commutation relation. Q commute with D is IQ. That's not Heisenberg's relation, Q commute with P equals I. You remember Q commute with P equals I has minimum uncertainty states. You can talk about the minimum uncertainty of that and find that Gaussians are the minimum uncertainty states associated with the Heisenberg variable. Well, these are the affine variables, Q commute with D equal IQ. You can ask for the minimum uncertainty states in that case and find out what those functions are. You can also ask, what are the maximal weight vectors of this particular group representation? That's another little more technical statement about it. And what you find is not a Gaussian in this particular case. You find, since the Q has got to be positive, and that means that the X in the representation has got to be positive, you find X to a power, beta minus a half, actually, e to the minus beta X as the ground state functions, proportionality up to a normalization, of which are the family of minimum uncertainty states. Okay, choose those. Choose those, and with those, you can find the complete overlap function that's appropriate to the two coherent states, to the coherent states in this situation. I want to look on this transparency, but let's see what's involved. It involves the parameter beta,
beta, which is right here, which is like the omega, the angular frequency, the width of the Gaussian in the, your discussion of the minimum uncertainty states for the Heisenberg operators. Q's are always positive, so that they can have inverses as well. So here's a Q prime inverse, Q double prime inverse. These things are therefore normalization. That is to say, if I want to put this label equal to that label, the P's will disappear. These things become identical, become one of those. These become identical. That cancels, and I get number one out of that. More important for you to observe is that this is, forgetting this factor, analytic function of its arguments. There's Q double prime inverse plus I over beta P double prime. So funny argument, it's not Q plus IP, but this one is Q inverse plus IP. And this is the adjoint of that, Q inverse minus IP for the right-hand label. That is an analytic character that we will find useful when we take up this question again in our next and final lecture. Did you do it?
I did.